You are listening to America's Web Radio, your voice in the matter.
Good morning. Time for another edition of the Doctor's Lounge here on America's Web Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. I alternate weeks with Dr. Hal Schertz, and you're lucky enough because it's my turn this week. Thank you very much for spending time with us this morning. The Doctor's Lounge is sponsored by the Docs for Patient Care Foundation. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to the empowerment of doctors and patients with bias-free information to provide the means for doctors and patients to make informed, effective decisions together without the interference of government, with minimized interference from third-party payers. And we just want your care to be the best it can be. So thank you very much for spending time with us this morning. We begin with a bit of a programming note. Consistent with the best laid plans of mice and men, we had a guest lined up for this morning, and at the last minute, less than 24 hours ago, that whole thing fell through, and that didn't give me a whole lot of time to scramble and fill the gap this morning. At age 53, I think I've lost the ability to pull an all-nighter and do this sort of thing, so I prepared as much as we can. I think we can get through about two segments live with some really good stuff. I decided I would rather do two good segments than four crappy ones. So we're going to do at least two, and if the material I prepared lasts longer, we'll go longer live and then fill in with some good stuff from the year before. But I beg your pardon for that, it happens. It is what it is. Anyhow, it is springtime in Atlanta, if you haven't figured that out already. It's easy to figure out when wintertime ends in Atlanta and springtime begins, because we get a very impressive green up when everything goes from looking dead to looking very much alive. But the border between spring and summer is a little harder to figure out. It seems that we get a few weeks in the 50s and 60s and some beautiful weather, and then a storm front comes through, and then it's sweltering hot after that, and we're kind of right around there someplace. But you know summertime's coming, because this is graduation season with all of the accompanying celebrations. This year we were close as a family, the Karuchak family, close to that. We have a son who is finishing his junior year, and seeing all this happen and thinking we're going to be directly involved and watch my children finish their journey to adulthood, I'm trying to figure out how I can be so happy about it and so sad about it all at the same time. But that's kind of where my heart and mind are this time of year. Anyhow, as we spend more and more time on this radio show, and we're coming up on our one-year anniversary, by the way, that I think it'll be, what, David, June 12th or June 14th, 2014 was our first show. But we've been talking about a lot of issues for a while, right? We've been talking about Obamacare and the excessive role of government in all forms, not just Obamacare, in our lives, interfering with the doctor-patient relationship. We've talked about maintenance of certification issues, malpractice reform, and, of course, nearest and dearest to me, the issues surrounding health information technology. But as a part of all of this, we are occasionally the board members of the Docs for Patient Care Foundation are asked a question about, so how does this impact your daily life as a physician, right? I mean, we talk about concepts. We talk about interference with the doctor-patient relationship. We talk about what happens to doctors and patients as a result of all this stuff. But sometimes people sort of get around all the theoreticals and say, okay, doc, how did this affect you in your office today or yesterday? And sometimes those examples are harder to just come up with off the top of your head than you would think. So what I've tried to do occasionally is when I come across something in my work day, like I did yesterday, try to remember that and write down a couple of details and present that to you as a part of the next show. So I managed to actually do that successfully yesterday, and I've got a decent example for you of how our problems in the healthcare system today affect my daily life and, more importantly, the daily lives of my patients. So I have an example for you. So this is a patient of mine who needs a couple of very simple procedures done. One is a procedure inside his nose to improve his nasal airway, right? For those of you who understand the technical stuff, it's called a turbinate reduction. If you don't understand that, don't worry about it. It's a simple procedure you do on the nose. If allergy medications don't open the nose properly and you have a simple anatomic problem, we have an office procedure that can fix that. He also needs a benign tumor removed from his neck, and it's called a lipoma. And if you're a doctor, you know what that is. It's a benign fatty tumor. Again, if that doesn't make sense to you, don't worry about it. Suffice it to say, two very simple, very common procedures. So I saw him in the office a few weeks ago when we talked about each of these procedures and the risks involved and the plan we wanted to do. We decided we were going to go up to the operating room and do this. And so we signed him up. We went through the informed consent process and the risks and the benefits and all the things that medically you are supposed to do that are appropriate. And we went to the process of getting him scheduled. Well, he calls back a couple of days later. He says, look, I'm not sure I want to do this. I'm not sure I want to do this because I don't know what it's going to cost me. I have a high deductible health plan. I have a health savings account. But a lot of this is going to be my own money. And I don't want to do this procedure unless you can tell me what it's going to cost. This is now a situation where he has to spend the money himself. It's not this ethereal insurance benefit thing anymore. It is money that's coming directly out of his pocket that he can't spend on other things. Right? Perfectly appropriate, perfectly reasonable request, right? I mean, if you're going to go into Best Buy or, you know, an electronics appliance store and you want to buy a washer dryer or a big screen TV, if the sales rep said, well, you know, we can't tell you what it costs, you just give us our credit card, you give us your credit card, and we're going to swipe that credit card and you're going to take your washer dryer or your TV home, and you're not even going to know what it costs you until your statement comes 2-3 weeks later. Then you can decide, I got ripped off, or I got a great price. Now, who would agree to that? Obviously, nobody would agree to that. But essentially, in healthcare, that is what we do. And that's kind of ridiculous. So we tried to honor this patient's request as best we could. And my assistant, Kelly, and maybe she's listening this morning, if I'm going to give her a shout-out and brag about how good she is at what she does and how hard she works. But she worked a couple of weeks on this, making phone calls everywhere, trying to figure out what it's going to cost this patient to have this done. Now realize that the cost of a procedure, right, the cost of going to the operating room and having a surgical procedure done, is going to break down into three categories. The first is the surgeon's fee, right? That is what I charge, and you'd think I would know what I charge, but I don't know what I charge, and I can't know what I charge, and you wouldn't believe how complicated it is. But the first is the surgeon's fee. It's the money I'm going to get for doing your procedure. The second category of expense has to do with the fact that I have to do this procedure someplace that it's safe to operate, right? There has to be a surgical facility that has a pre-op area, operating rooms that are properly built and cared for and maintained, and a post-op care area, and all of that involves a fee. So you have, and that's all lumped into something called the facility fee. So you have the surgeon's fee, you have the facility fee, right? I get the surgeon's fee. I don't get the facility fee. That goes to the facility. And then the third is anesthesia. Right? Usually you need some sort of sedation or at least some sort of pain control, either local anesthesia, sedation, or a general anesthetic. Where do you go to sleep? And obviously there is a cost involved with the proper and safe care of a patient who is undergoing anesthesia. So those are the three components of cost for a surgical procedure. So late yesterday, Kelly left this patient a message with the numbers that we got for the facility fee, which if we do enough research, we can find, and the surgeon's fee, which you can do enough research and find. The anesthesia fee, you can't even get that. I mean, we have a great anesthesia group, but we don't have any way. It's a separate group, and we don't have any way of getting inside the machine if they're not willing to, you know, give us numbers up front. And that's just the reality. And because of the regulatory environment, I'd like to sit here and tell you exactly what the sum of those two numbers were. Right, the surgeon's fee and the facility fee, but all I feel comfortable saying on the air is that it was somewhere between $1 and $10,000. And because of the regulatory issues, I'm half afraid sitting here to give you a more specific number than that. But we called the patient and we left a message, and I'm guessing based on that number, he's probably going to pass on those procedures because he's not going to be able to afford it. So what are the take-home lessons here? Well, the first is that this is sad, right? It is perfectly reasonable. It is perfectly intelligent in medicine for patients to ask for prices up front for the care that they are contemplating, right? We do that in every other sector of the economy. We talked about this example with buying a TV or buying a washer dryer. If we can do it in other parts of the economy, we can do it in medicine. And if we did that, we would introduce downward pressure on prices the same way we see in other parts of the economy. Why is it that cell phones are so dirt cheap? Why is it that that LASIK surgery and plastic surgery, those prices have come down so far since they were initially introduced? It's because people know up front what they're going to pay, and they can make a decision about whether the value is there for that kind of price or not. So the second is it shouldn't be that hard, right? The second take-home lesson is it should be easy for us. It should be as easy as it is at Best Buy, where the prices sit right up there, you know, in front of the TV or in front of the washing machine. And, you know, you can glance at it and walk right past if the price is unreasonable. The reason it's so difficult for us to get numbers, the reason I'm afraid to give you the exact total that I was going to give this patient, is because the complexity of health insurance and the regulations that cover what we do and how we do it are so complex that if you try to do the right thing, if you try to give a patient a price, or you try to publish prices publicly so that people can sort of walk past your storefront and see if they want to do business with you or not, you may unknowingly commit insurance fraud. You may unknowingly break the law, or you may invoke a part of most insurance contracts called a most favored nation clause that says that if you offer a better price to another entity than the one that's in the contract in question, that you have to bring the prices down to match. And so you might inadvertently underbid yourself in the quest to give a patient a decent price for what they're doing because they're cash paying. And for years, for most of the 20 years that I have been in private practice and I have been in Atlanta, we have debated off and on and discussed off and on how to safely offer a price list. And it's difficult. And it's a little bit risky. And so we, again, have this here. So here's a real-world example. And here's the third take-home lesson of why prices are ridiculously high, is that because we have third-party payers, and because for the vast majority of the dollars that are spent on healthcare, and that patients choose to, you know, when they make decisions, they're not making decisions with their own money. And it costs us money. It cost me, I mean, I don't know what the cost was, you know, at my assistant Kelly's, you know, hourly rate plus the benefits that she has. But, you know, it was probably on the order of several hundred dollars. It may have cost more for me to have an assistant do the research and make the phone calls and play the phone tag to get the prices than it would have to actually do the procedure. So what should have happened? What should have happened? A free market-based healthcare system would completely avoid this unpleasant situation. Right? If we had prices that were readily available, that were transparent and negotiable, then I wouldn't have had to pay hundreds of dollars for my staff to research this stuff. And if I wanted to charge a patient $5,000, for instance, to do a procedure, let's just assume it was $5,000, then go across the street and see if they can get it done for $4,000. And then they can come back to me and see if I want to match the price. And then I would have the option of either accepting the lower number or letting the business walk out the door. Or if the doctor across the street has a lower price, maybe I'm better than that doctor. Maybe there's a reason why I would charge a higher price, right? Maybe there's a reason that a BMW costs more than a Toyota, and then it's the patient's ability to choose. Maybe they want BMW care, maybe they want Toyota care. But the bottom line is, just like in cosmetic surgery and LASIK surgery, price transparency and competition would have made all of this problem go away. And odds are I could have given this patient, this real-world patient who has a name and has a chart in my practice, I probably could have given them a price that was less than half of the price I quoted him, and we'd probably have this procedure done already. And not only would I have been able to provide the care, have the money in my pocket, I probably wouldn't have had to have spent hundreds of dollars paying my staff to do very, very complicated research. We could have given a price quote in 15 minutes instead of 15 days. You know, I'm happy to negotiate with patients for lower prices because then I don't have to have all of that extra overhead. And everybody wins in that situation. Everybody wins except one of the competitive stakeholders in healthcare, which would be the insurance companies. Right? Because realize that under our current flawed third-party payer system, that every dollar that is spent, only about 70 or 80 cents actually gets to care. The other 20 cents goes to insurance / administrative overhead. And if you could get rid of that 20% administrative markup for the vast majority of care, right, the non-emergent care, the non-catastrophic care, the checkups, the flu shots, all that stuff, we would generate a huge amount of money that allows patients to win and secondarily, doctors to win so that we can provide care for a lower price and ultimately pass the benefits that we as physicians gain on to our patients. We've reached the end of the first segment. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship.
I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak, co-host of The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Please join us in the fight to save the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper and go to this website, www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on americaswebradio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on americaswebradio.com anytime you like.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thank you for sticking with us. We are kind of ad-libbing it this morning. We are going to talk a little bit in the third and fourth segments about something called big data. We're going to talk about the promise of big data, the unfulfilled promise of big data, perhaps even the empty promises of big data. We'll get to that a little later. I'm kind of finishing up this example right now of a patient that I had in my office that wanted a very simple pair of procedures done. Should be very easy stuff. It is, you know, from an administrative standpoint and a billing standpoint, as simple as healthcare gets, but was still very complicated. Unfortunately, we really weren't able to serve this patient adequately. We weren't able to give him the information that he wanted and certainly had a right to have regarding what it was going to cost him up front. And finally getting around to saying that if we had a system that put most of routine healthcare into something that was not insurance, right? Something like the direct primary care model that our president, Dr. Gross in Florida, is championing and doing very well. Something that at least puts, you know, dollar cost with the patient, give the patient skin in the game, give them the financial means to spend their own money or save their own money. You will get a couple of very good things happening. One is all of the insurance markup and all of the inefficiency for the vast majority of care, routine care, which is the vast majority of healthcare. Checkups, basic stuff, vaccines, flu shots, all becomes something that patients pay for. You will see downward pressure on prices because patients aren't going to pay their own money unless it's a good deal. I mean, that's how things work. That's why prices on technology come down. That's why prices on LASIK surgery for your eyes have come down. That's why cell phone prices come down. The phones get more and more powerful, and the prices stay about the same. And so we had just about finished up that argument. I'm going to sort of take this one step further and go back to a book that I had reviewed a couple of weeks ago by an author named David Goldhill. He's the CEO of the Game Show Network, of all things. And he wrote this great book called Catastrophic Care, Why Everything We Think We Know About Healthcare Is Wrong. And there's a section about two-thirds of the way through the book where he develops a hypothetical model. And it is a hypothetical model, admit that up front. But it really does offer some very, very interesting insights into how much money we pay. Each one of us pays for healthcare over a lifetime and how there's are some easy, obvious ways to manage that money in a more efficient manner than paying insurance premiums from the moment you're born and collecting benefits, collecting entitlements, and how inefficient that can be. So here's a theoretical example. So let's say a baby is born today, and let's assume two numbers about that child. The first is a life expectancy of 80 years. Now, you can argue that should be higher or that should be lower, and that a child born today may have a higher life expectancy, but let's stick with round numbers for the sake of argument. 80 years. Let's also take a number that the spending per year on that child for health care, and we're going to borrow at the average number, right? The average per capita spending in the United States is about $8,500 per year. Now, we're going to stick with a very statistically simple model. We're going to ignore, for the purposes of argument, that that $8,500 is going to go up every year, and that by the end of that child's 80-year lifetime, it's probably going to be four or five times that, even with just inflation. We're also going to ignore the fact that that if we give that child an allowance of $8,500 per year, we're going to ignore the interest-related growth of that money. But let's just assume that $8,500 per year that we spend in the United States, that we're going to give that child $8,500 a year from some source. It doesn't matter what the source is. It could be that instead of that child paying insurance premiums, they pay into something, into an account, or there's a benefit or something. It doesn't matter. But the point is, there is an arbitrary account set up for that child, and every year that child gets $80,500 to go towards health care. And obviously, for the first, you know, statistically, for the first, you know, 30 or 40 years of that child's life, their health care costs are going to be minimal. Right? It's going to be restricted to non-catastrophic, most likely, hopefully. And so there may be a couple of $1,000 per year drawn off of that, maybe less, maybe $500 per year for well child checks and vaccines and school physicals and that kind of stuff. And then a tiny amount drawn off for catastrophic only insurance, right? To cover the God forbid events, to cover the car accidents and the cancers and that kind of thing. And that would probably be offset by the interest growth in the money that's left. But if you crunch those numbers, by the time that child reaches 30 years old, there should be something on the order of $250,000 in that child's health savings account. Now it's an adult. It's a 30-year-old adult. So at some point then, one of three things happens. Either this person remains healthy and their health care costs continue to be low, as it will be for most 30-year-olds, so that in any given single year, and again, this is a very important sort of statistical distinction, and this is one that, according to Mr. Goldhill, is lost among a lot of healthcare gurus, among a lot of consultants and talking heads, is the statistical difference between becoming severely ill, right, significantly ill, gravely ill in 1 year versus the odds of getting ill somewhere across an entire lifetime, right? And these are very different, right? The odds of getting severely ill in any single year is very small. The odds of getting ill somewhere across the course of your lifetime, right? This 30-year-old's got 50 years to live. Obviously, the odds of a severe illness somewhere along the line, I mean, if nothing else, obviously that person's not going to live forever. They're going to get sick and pass away sometime. So the odds of becoming severely ill at some point are very, very high. In fact, the only way to avoid illness before death is if you have a car accident or a fall or something like that, or something, a cancer that takes your life very quickly. But the odds are, any given individual, you or me, somewhere along the line, that you're going to have years somewhere in your life with very high healthcare expenses. But in any given year, especially for a 30-year-old, any given single year, the odds of a high healthcare expense year are very low for that year. So with this hypothetical 30-year-old, one of three things happens in any given year. Either the healthcare costs remain very low and you get to keep most of your $8,500 per year allowance. You get an illness in the intermediate range, like a mild to moderate car accident, something that, let's say for this 30-year-old, creates expenses of $300,000 or $400,000, but they survive. Now, if that's the case, the amount of money that you owe for health care exceeds the $250,000 that's in your account, but it does not exceed your total lifetime average healthcare spending of $6,500 per year, which over a life expectancy of 80 years is about $700,000, $680,000 to be exact. So let's say that in this individual's 30th year, they have $300,000 worth of expenses for healthcare. Let's say they have a statistically unlikely year. They get sick, they get in a car accident, something happens, and they need to spend a lot of money, but over a very short time, and it's going to end. They're going to get the money. They're going to get their $700,000 eventually, but they don't have it in the account right now. So Mr. Goldhill says, look, that's not an insurance situation. That should be something akin to a loan that says, look, we're going to spend the $250,000, right? If the bill is $300,000, I got to borrow $50,000 from somewhere. But whoever lends me or lends that patient the $50,000, we know we're good for it because there's going to be another $8,500 of average healthcare spending per year that's going to come available to pay that loan off. So you have scenario one is patient stays healthy. They get to keep all their money. Scenario two is that they get healthcare expenses that are somewhere that are high in the short term but still remain below the lifetime average. And so that ought to be a loan, not insurance. And then you have the third situation, which I haven't discussed yet, I'm going to tell you right now, which is the catastrophic thing, where healthcare expenses go into the millions of dollars, you know, sort of in the liver transplant range or something like that, where their healthcare costs or long-term chronic illness, let's say, where their lifetime healthcare costs will exceed the $680,000 average lifetime healthcare cost per individual. And that's a situation where the catastrophic insurance would kick in. And that's a very interesting statistical underpinning for managing healthcare costs in this country. And it's a great statistical support for putting, relegating the role of insurance to true insurance. Right. And what is true insurance? Remember, true insurance is where, you know, for the cost of your insurance premium, you sell your risk of an unlikely but catastrophic event to an insurer. And that's what your premium's for. And if you happen to be one of the statistical few that has that event occur, the insurance will make you whole from a financial standpoint, right? That's how car insurance works. That's how life insurance works, term life insurance. That's how all of those work. And that's how health insurance ought to work. And for the vast majority of routine care, that stuff comes out of some sort of health savings account, but it's your money. As a patient, it's your money, and so you have skin in the game. You're still going to look for the best deal, and you're going to make decisions about health care the same way you make decisions about buying flat-screen TVs or cars or appliances or clothes or anything else. Now, again, admit it up front, this is a theoretical argument, but there are some countries that do this to some degree. And again, I'm quoting from Mr. Goldhill's book. Not my ideas, they're his. But he talks about Singapore, the country of Singapore. And that's an interesting country to bring up because if you listen to the propaganda from people who talk about how bad they think the healthcare is in this country, they will quote things like infant mortality and life expectancy and say, we spend a ton of money for that in this country and we get terrible results. Look at a country like Singapore, right? Singapore only spends 4% of their gross domestic product on healthcare compared to the United States that spends 17% of its domestic healthcare product on healthcare. And yet the statistics, if you look at those statistics, and we're not going to go into why those are bad statistics, but you know, we've done that before. And they say, look at Singapore. Singapore has national healthcare. They spend far less money relative to GDP on healthcare, and they get numbers that are as good as ours. And I think if you look at things like infant mortality rate, I think Singapore, if you look at that one number, which is misleading by itself, I think Singapore actually does better. I didn't have a chance to look that up, so I might be wrong about that. But Mr. Goldhill refutes that and says, look, if you want to talk about Singapore, let's talk about Singapore. Let's go ahead and talk about Singapore. Singapore's national health plan actually has five parts to it. And I think we're coming up on the end of the segment here. So when we start the third segment, we're going to talk a little bit about Singapore's healthcare, then go on to big data. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
This is Tracy Pearson with Prissy Tomboy. Listen to the Prissy Tomboy radio show every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time as I interview special guests that will inspire adventure and fitness for females.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. This is your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thank you for sticking with us. It looks like we're going to have enough material to go live for the entire hour, or at least for one more segment. So you're going to get the real deal here, sir. Stick around. We were talking about the country of Singapore. Why were we doing such an apparently crazy thing? Because the people who like to attack our healthcare system, and it happened a lot during the big debate on Obamacare back in 2008, 2009, would say, oh my gosh, the United States has terrible statistics on infant mortality, on life expectancy, on access to care, yada, yada, yada. And because of that, you know, we need to change this to a, you know, cradle-to-grave national healthcare system, kind of like Britain has. Or, you know, they would even suggest to you, kind of like Singapore has, and that with a national government-sponsored cradle-to-grave, free care for everyone, yeah, it's a laugh, you know, healthcare system, that this would, you know, lower our cost down to where Singapore's costs are, right? Singapore spends 4% of its GDP on healthcare. The United States spends 17% of its GDP on healthcare. And yet, according to their propaganda, Singapore's better. Right, because its infant mortality rate is at least equal to ours, and maybe it's a little bit better than ours if you just look at that number. So you want to talk about Singapore? Fine. Fine. We'll talk about Singapore. Let's talk about Singapore. Singapore's healthcare system is not a cradle-to-grave, fully government-sponsored, totally free care system. That's not what it is. It's not like the National Health Service in Britain. It is not that the minute you get sick, you walk into a government-sponsored healthcare facility and get all your care for free. No. Not even close. Right? Singapore has five parts to its healthcare system. Okay, the first part is a program that they call MediSave. All right, what's MediSave? MediSave is a program that requires all employees, everybody who's working and drawing a paycheck, is required to save between 6.5% and 9% of their savings. And think about that. That's a chunk of money. Right? I mean, if you make $50,000 a year, that means you might be putting as much as $4,500 a year into a health savings account. It's required. It's not just an option. It is required. Then that goes into a health savings account, which can be used for two things. One is to directly pay for care. The other is to fund your insurance premium that goes into the second part of Singapore's healthcare program, which is a government-sponsored insurance program. All right, and this is not a Medicare thing, I don't think, and I didn't have a chance to research this, so I might be wrong. My impression from what I had a chance to read is that it is not like Medicare. It is a government-sponsored insurance program, but I don't know that it's exactly like Medicare. But even if it is, so what? It certainly is unlike Medicare in that it only covers catastrophic stuff. So if you make $50,000 a year, you have to put $4,500 of that into a health savings account. You draw money out of that to pay an insurance premium to the government, and you use it to directly fund care. So those are the first two components. Now, there are two more components, which are that there is a separate government insurance pool for disabled individuals, right? So folks who fall into a different risk category because of a chronic disease, whatever, are in a different insurance pool. And there is a third government insurance pool, for the poor, for folks who can't pay their bills. I assume that means if your HSA is burned up and there's no more money to pay direct, you fall into this other one. But no matter which program you fall in, and I think they go to great pains to make sure this is true, no matter which of those programs you fall into, that you will always be paying some of your own money for care. There are no scenarios, at least as I understand, in reading the chapter out of David Goldhill's book, there are no scenarios in the Singapore healthcare system that will have you getting free care, as it is colloquially understood, meaning that you don't pay anything out of your own checkbook for an episode of care. That means that in our vernacular here in America, everybody's got skin in the game. Doesn't matter if you're disabled, doesn't matter if you're elderly, doesn't matter what it is, you always have skin in the game. So that means there is downward pressure on healthcare prices for every sector of Singapore's healthcare system. It is, in fact, Goldhill argues, appropriately I think, the exact opposite of our system, in which there is no downward pressure on prices, and that we have, you know, price never matters. Even when patients have to pay directly or indirectly, price never matters. Because ultimately, and Goldhill develops this in other chapters of the book, showing that, you know, a healthy person may pay well over $1 million if you count their Medicare premiums and everything else. They may pay well over $1 million in the course of a lifetime for healthcare premiums and healthcare. But we have so scrambled the system that nobody knows what it costs, right? I can't even tell one of my patients what something simple is going to cost. And so we have this huge problem in our system. But you know what? If you want to make our system like Singapore's system, heck, that'd be significant improvement for sure. I think I might go for that. I think there are better ideas than that, but that would be a significant improvement over what we have now. I'd love to know, and again, I didn't have a chance, given the conditions for today's show, to research some of Singapore's other healthcare statistics. How many uninsured do they have? That kind of thing. But anyway, so goes the story on Singapore. So now we're going to get to the topic that we had promised in some of the announcing, you know, some of the social media stuff we had go out in advance of the show. And I have been meaning to talk about this subject. We're going to circle back around to health information technology here for a little while and talk about something that maybe you've heard of, maybe you hadn't. Within health IT circles, I think everybody has heard of it within information technology. Outside of that, maybe you've heard of it, maybe you haven't. It's something called, drum roll please, big data. Right? The term is called big data, and usually that's big with a capital B and data with a capital D. It's called big data. And what is that? What does big data mean? Well, big data is premised on the notion that for at least the last 20 years, maybe longer for larger institutions, we have been collecting data on every single episode of care that has occurred in the United States. Now, this predates the use of electronic medical record systems because we have been submitting claims electronically for at least the past 20 years. Larger institutions were probably longer than that, maybe 30 years, maybe longer. So we have decades of data archived about what people are getting in terms of their illness and what we're doing to care for them. Now, obviously, since the advent of EMRs, and again, you know, the market penetration has just been the last 3-4 years since the Meaningful Use Program, the ill-advised, misguided Meaningful Use Program, that we've had EMRs do this. But obviously the concept of having electronic medical records in addition to claims data has sort of, you know, thrown gasoline on the big data fire. at least in theory, about what should be, what we should be capable of. And so the premise is, look, we got tons of data, right? We got at least ICD data and CPT data going back 20, 30 years. We may have more granular data, more clinical data, you know, housed in EMRs for maybe the last 3 or 4 years. And there must be a way. There must be a way, right? We've been, you know, if you listen to the gurus, we've had, in the past 5 years, and again, this comment goes beyond healthcare, at least this statistic goes beyond healthcare. In the past 5 years, we as a human race have captured more data in the past 5 years than we had in the entire history of mankind up to that point. Now, that does make sense. If you think about it, right? I mean, just look at your kids for crying out loud. I mean, my two kids have probably captured more photo and video data on their smartphones. You know, I think they may have beaten the entire history of mankind up to the year of their birth just by themselves. Because everything gets videoed. Kind of annoys the crap out of me, actually. Everything gets videoed. Everything gets photographed. Everything gets shared, posted on social media. But think about what that's doing to our children's mentality. And this may be a good thing. You know, for once, I'm not going to say it's a bad thing. I'm going to say it may well be a good thing. Because think about what our children are used to doing as second nature. They don't even think about it, which is the sharing of data. They share data. Now, it's social data. I mean, it's not, clinically useful data. I'm not sure it's data that's useful in any way. But our children's delicate new brains are being wired every day in ways that encourage them to share data with each other. And I would offer the highly speculative, highly uncertain guess that it is going to change how they behave as adults. It is going to change how they behave as adults in the business world. It's obviously going to change how they behave in their personal lives. It already has. So if you combine these two concepts, one is that we are capturing vast amounts of data. You can't even put your arms around how much data we're capturing as a society, and therefore how much data that we're capturing as healthcare is given every day. Combine that with the change, the cultural change, the gray matter change, right? The neuroplastic wiring changes inside the brains of our next generation to be willing to share data and to develop mental skills in data sharing that you and I as middle-aged adults can't really comprehend, even people like me who like IT and are into it. If you combine those two concepts, there must be a way. There must be a way to use that data and put it to good use. And there's examples, there's a few very, very good examples. You know, we have the sequencing of the human genome, right? How many bytes are in the human genome? It probably takes about 3 billion bytes, right? There's 3 billion base pairs in the human genome. If you don't know what a base pair is in DNA, doesn't matter. But for the physicians listening, right, the DNA, our human genome, has 3 billion base pairs, right? That's 3 billion pieces of information. And we have sequenced that. And once you sequence what a healthy person is supposed to look like, then you sequence what, folks with different ethnic backgrounds look like, and then you sequence what disease processes look like. And the intuitive use of that is clear. Right? There must be a way to use that stuff and learn stuff from it in a way that will benefit mankind, to make care better, to reduce costs, to anticipate what's going to happen to people before it happens so that you can head off a bad event before it happens. And that's got to be a good thing. Intuitively, people think that's got to be a good thing. And it's hard to argue that point. We are at the end of the third segment. I think I'm going to make it the whole hour. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's D-O-C-S, the number 4, patientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Don't be hoodwinked by the left, who wants you to believe the fairy tale that we can power America on butterflies, rainbows, and pixie dust. I'm Marita Noon. Get the truth about energy on my show, America's Voice for Energy, only on America's Web Radio.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Karuchak. Thanks very much for sticking with us all the way through the hour. It's going to be hit or miss whether we make it through the fourth segment before we run out of gas in terms of what we have prepared, but we will do the best we can. We are talking about the promise of big data. Right? What is big data? Big data is this idea that as a society we are collecting huge amounts of information, not only about healthcare but everything else, everything from our kids with their smartphones to new techniques of analyzing data. And this is a very interesting thing. There are, and I hadn't even realized this until I did a little bit of research last night. There was one particular article that I pulled that talked about a researcher that was looking at how tuberculosis bacteria grow. And this researcher had come up with a technology that had was able to take, time-lapse photography. That's the term I'm looking for. Time-lapse photography of TB, you know, tuberculous bacteria, tuberculosis organisms growing in culture. And they were able to do time-lapse photography on growing cultures and get these images that if you put them all together, you literally get a fast motion movie of TB cultures growing. And that's great data to have. The question is, what the heck do you do with it? It becomes one of these issues that, I think is one of the weaknesses of big data, which is this whole solution in search of a problem sort of concept. So, the question is, you spend all this money, you put all these hours, and you come up with these movies of TB bacteria growing. What the heck do you do with it? How do you analyze that? And so that's the problem that this researcher was up against. And then she came across somebody who was a vendor of crowdsourcing services, right? Now, what is crowdsourcing? Well, crowdsourcing is where, through the miracles of modern internet technology, you can take a database and you can farm it out to anybody who wants to volunteer. So you can take these images of tuberculosis bacteria growing and farm those images out to anybody who wants to volunteer to manually analyze the image. Now, isn't that ironic? And it made me wonder why it is that you have to crowdsource this stuff out to people. Why can't you come up with a computer protocol that analyzes your images? For some reason, that wasn't a possibility that the article I read raised. But be that as it may, they substituted a human technology for an all-computer technology and figured out how to take these images of these movies, if you will, of TB bacteria growing and crowdsource them out to thousands of people, volunteers working on their own PCs at home that would somehow, with an image on a screen, would humanly analyze this thing. I don't know if they were drawing outlines around the cells growing or what, but then they were able to figure things out about how TB bacteria grow. And one of the interesting things I think they found out was that TB bacteria, they grow from only one end. They don't grow from both ends out. They have one end that's growing and one end that's not. I don't know what that's good for. But I thought it was a very interesting example, although there was a certain amount of irony to it, because I was like, well, why don't you just have the computer analyze the images? Why are we having human beings analyze the images? But fine, be that as it may, it's a good story to tell, and it does show how, you know, some of the technologies that are out there that allow data to be shared, right? Because this was certainly an excellent exercise in data sharing. How data sharing was able to take this stuff, from a problem you couldn't solve to a problem that you could solve. So very interesting stuff. But here's the problem. Here's the problem with big data is that culturally, big data involves a fundamental change about how we solve problems in science, not just medicine in particular, but in science. Now, what the heck do I mean by that? I mean that that big data is often a solution in search of a problem. What the heck do I mean by that? Well, go back to what I said in the third segment. We said that there's so much data out there, and we now have the cultural means to share that data because of how our children are growing up, that must be good for something. So we're going to go out there and analyze the heck out of data, and we're going to learn things. Now, that concept, as feel good as it seems, flies in the face of scientific method, right? Scientific method works exactly the reverse. In scientific method, the researcher, the scientist, if you will, develops a hypothesis first. Right, we don't say we're going to do an experiment and just see what happens. Right, you develop a hypothesis first. So, for example, in my own field, right, I treat a lot of allergy patients and I treat a lot of reflux patients. So, if I were going to use big data in my practice, I would love to know among all the foods that I tell my patients with reflux to avoid. Right, it is generally accepted that if you're going to give dietary advice to a reflux patient, and obviously you always should, that in my world there are six foods that you avoid, or six habits at least: tobacco, alcohol, caffeine, chocolate, peanut butter, peppermint, right? I'm going to die with those words on my lips. I say them so much. After my conscious brain is gone, I'll probably be saying those three, six: tobacco, alcohol, caffeine, chocolate, peanut butter, peppermint. But there's no data to prove which of those are most important, which are less important. When I was in training at Vanderbilt, we used to hand people a list of about 50 foods to avoid. Now, I think that's not practical. I don't think you can tell a patient to avoid 50 foods. So I chose arbitrarily, right? No science behind it, no nothing. I said, okay, these are probably the worst ones: tobacco, alcohol, caffeine, chocolate, peanut butter, peppermint. I'm going to ignore the other 44 foods that were on the original list that I had to give people when I was a fellow and I'm in training. But it'd be nice to have some science behind that. So why couldn't I use big data to figure out what foods people are eating and try to correlate that with how successful their reflux therapy is or how severe their reflux is in the first place? Is there data inside my EMR that would allow me to go back 10 years and try to correlate which foods are the worst and which aren't so bad so that I could give my patients statistically based advice on diet as opposed to winging it? Now, that would be something that I think that, the big data could solve for me, and that would be a great thing. But note how I did that. I did that by scientific method. My hypothesis would be that tobacco, alcohol, and caffeine are probably the three worst ones, and the other ones have less effect than those top three. That's my hypothesis. Now I'm going to go design an experiment or a big data analytics method that can go back into my SQL database for my electronic medical record system and try to solve that. But I'm going to come up with the hypothesis first, then I'm going to design the experiment, then I'm going to look at the results, and then I'm going to draw my conclusions. That's how the scientific method is supposed to work. What the big data propagandists tell you works in the opposite direction. All we're going to do, and at least some authors actually admit that the big data science is going to be hypothesis generating, not hypothesis driven. That's the terminology they use, right? What I'm describing to you as a scientific method is hypothesis driven. I, the researcher with my gray matter, come up with a hypothesis as step one, and then I design the experiment to test those hypotheses. These guys, who are big data propagandists, and there are many, turn that on its ear and say, no, we're just going to turn the computers loose. I don't even know what the hell that means. I mean, you have to have a protocol. You have to have something that you're looking for so that you can design your data collection and then design your analysis. I'm not sure how you do that the other way. It reminds me, and maybe, David, you remember this, right? You remember the old Batman series, right? I'm not talking about the movies. I'm talking about the 1960s, Adam West, Burt Ward, right? Burgess Meredith, all these guys doing that silly, crazy Batman series, and they had this thing called the Bat Computer, right? Remember? And if they wanted to figure out which criminal had stolen the paintings from the Gotham City Museum, they just took the entire Gotham City phone book and dumped it in a drawer in the Bat Computer, and all the lights would flash, and this little piece of paper would spit out, and they'd read it, and they'd go, aha! It was the Joker. Now, you know, that was the 1960s impressions of how computers worked, and it's humorous and it's a laugh, but 50 years after that, that's exactly what big data propagandists are telling us about how big data works. All we got to do is throw the equivalent of the Gotham City phone book, right? In this case, our EMR database. All I got to do is throw our EMR database into the back computer, and it's just going to spit out answers. We're not even asking questions. It's just going to spit out answers. It's going to spit out useful information that we didn't even know we needed. And that just doesn't make any sense to me. I can't find, when I look through the literature on big data, I can't find any examples where that's actually happened, where someone just took a database and pushed it through a computer and came up with answers to questions that weren't even asked. It does not make any bloody sense to me. And right now, the propagandists, right, the people who write things like this thing, capitalizing on the promise of big data. Here's an article I got. This is from Price Waterhouse. This is all propaganda, right? The headlines on the pages, the headings on the pages. Your competitors may already be staking out first mover advantage. You know, they got all this stuff in here that says that, you know, big data is gonna disrupt, right? One of my favorite words. Big data is gonna disrupt your industry in the next 3 months. You need to get on board or you're gonna get left behind. Well, you know, most of this stuff is crap. Most of these reports that you read have no merit whatsoever, and they offer no examples of how they were actually able to throw a database into a bat computer and come out with answers to questions that they didn't even ask. There are, however, and I think I've got, 2 minutes left, 3 minutes left, 1 minute left, I'll be darned, is a couple of examples of where big data actually really works, and we'll go through those in the last minute. One comes from right here in my backyard at Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. This is a neat story. This is a twist on big data that's different than what the propagandists are telling you. They started off with a neonatal ICU. Right? In the neonatal ICU, there are monitors, right? Every baby in there is connected to a zillion monitors to monitor their pulse, their blood pressure, their respiratory rate, their oxygen saturation. Those are continuous monitors. Every one of those monitors is a small computer, and it has the ability to send all that information to a server to store that data. And in Scottish Rite, Children's Healthcare of Atlanta here in my town, working with students at Georgia Tech, figured out that there's a whole lot of data there they could look at, right? And this is good old-fashioned data. This is not EMR data. This is not something fancy. This is the stuff that's already getting monitored and captured and collected every day. And they said, look, we're gonna increase the sophistication of how we store and archive that data so we can search it. And then we're going to do this with scientific method. We're going to come up with a hypothesis. Our hypothesis is that environment and surgical procedures and those sorts of things have profound effects stress-wise on neonates that we are unrecognized because those patients are too young to talk for themselves. And sure enough, they figured out by monitoring and archiving and researching these vital signs, they were able to make significant improvements in healthcare for these neonates in the ICU. So there are some real-world examples. Maybe we'll finish this next time. Dang, we made it through the whole hour. You have been listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.